Hello and welcome to Season 12, Episode 5 of the Ubuntu Podcast. It's Monday, the 6th of May. In a break from tradition, we're recording on a Monday instead of a Tuesday. And I'm Mark, and joining me this week are Alan.
Hello.
And Martin.
Good evening.
And we're here to bring you our regular roundup of community news and events and some news headlines from the technosphere. Martin, what have you been doing since the last show?
I've not been reading the technosphere, that's for sure. I've been to Linux Fest Northwest.
Hey, I went there as well.
No way.
Oh, all right, you two.
Don't tell me that you rented a Dodge Challenger as well.
Yeah, I didn't intend renting a Dodge Challenger, but then no, the nice man at the Avis desk said, hey, would you like to have some fun?
So you've been driving muscle cars around the American Northwest?
We totally have. It was brilliant.
And was there any Linux involved at any point in this trip?
Yes. Yes, there was some Linux involved at this trip. We obviously went to Linux Fest Northwest, and we got there on the Thursday. We had a day to catch up with some friends, or an evening rather. And then on the Friday, we furiously did a bit of work, and we went up to Bellingham on the Friday afternoon for the pre-event party. And then it all kicked off big style on Saturday with the event itself. Now, I'd been before, but I know Alan hadn't. So I was interested to hear what Alan, you know, thought of it all, first impressions and everything.
Yeah, it was great. It was a really authentic, community-oriented Linux event, and it was made even better by there being lots of people I knew from the internet there who I could have a beer with and have a chat with and eat steak with and generally chill out. And lots of people I hadn't met before, and a bunch of talks, and it was really busy, and it was really nice. It made me feel a bit like Og Camp. Bigger, like quite a bit bigger, but still cool. Same kind of vibe, like, you know, friendly faces, the companies you know, and you know, people enthusiastic and wanting to do the right thing and make sure you're having a good time and make sure everything runs smoothly and all that kind of good jazz.
And were either of you presenting there, or were you just there for the funsies?
No, we were both presenting. I presented on the Sunday morning, and I presented an introduction to Snaps and Snapcraft that gave a little bit of a retrospective in how we got to where we are today to understand why Snaps have some of the features that they do. Mm-hmm. And then Alan chaired a Snapcraft workshop that afternoon.
Yeah, Martin's talk was rammed. It was standing room only in the room. There was like 50 odd people in there, and almost overran. Loads of questions, loads of like really sensible questions. And it's funny, we get similar questions most of the time when we run these things, but there are a few new ones, and they're all, you know, reasonable questions that people would ask. But I think we're getting our slides honed to the point where we're covering all the things that you'd likely ask in a question, so we start getting new questions, which is always good.
Yeah.
Because it challenges you a bit to answer new things rather than getting the same old three questions every single time.
Yeah. I particularly enjoyed, I went to a few sessions as well. I went to 50 Years of Unix with Mad Dog, and that was interesting. Alan described it as sitting around the campfire with granddad telling his stories, and it was a lot like that, but very enjoyable. And I also went to several of the talks presented by people from the Ubuntu community. So Simon from Ubuntu was there. Dustin from Ubuntu Budgie was there. Valerie from Kubuntu was there. And Eric from Ubuntu Studio was there. And I was able to represent Ubuntu Mate. So it was really nice to have, you know, lots of the flavors represented. And there were some really good positive discussions happening in the talks that they presented. And on a personal note, I don't remember your name, but there was a couple that had travelled all the way from Colorado, and they'd specially selected a beer from one of their local breweries that they'd brought along to share a beer with me, and that was very lovely. So thank you for going to all the effort for doing that. I did tell Alan that his bit of the beer was lovely as well, because I drank his too.
Out of a Paw Patrol cup, I think it was.
Yes, very tastefully chosen from Walmart.
Right. Well, on that note, it's time to move on. And now it's time for the community news and events. And first up in the community news this week, Dell has announced a line of budget-friendly Linux-based Dell Precision mobile workstations. So we're used to Dell releasing sort of developer edition Linux-based laptops where you can get them preloaded with Ubuntu, but they tend to be the higher-end, high-spec, lots of money models, whereas these are more of the sort of mid-range models that you might use for work. So they're a bit more bank account friendly, shall we say.
Are they though?
Well, if you compare them to, say, the XPS 13, you know, right. These are in the sort of $700 to $800 range rather than the $1,000 to $1,200 range.
I would never have used the word budget friendly for a $700 laptop. I mean, not as expensive as the XPS is a good phrase to use, but I think they're pushing it a bit with budget friendly. Now, obviously, they're relatively low end machines. Some of these, they're like less than 2 gigahertz clock CPU at the lowest end, like 1.6 gigahertz. And they have not a huge amount of RAM, and they've got integrated Intel graphics and 1366 by 768 displays. So, you know, at the low end, you're getting low end specs like spinning rust and all that kind of stuff. But interestingly, you get $66 knocked off if you switch from Windows to Ubuntu Linux. So that's a good thing.
Bargain.
Yep. And I went onto their configurator earlier, and it's very easy to turn that $702 starting price into many thousands of dollars, because you can add all the GPUs and all the CPUs and all the RAM and all the SSDs and everything else. So it's actually a very broad configuration option. So you can start at, you know, budget entry level specifications and go all the way to ridiculous, which is a lot of fun.
I feel like if you were going to go for the sky high spec, though, you'd want it in a nicer chassis than a Precision.
You can also add, for $245.70, CrowdStrike, Falcon Prevent, Device Control, Insight, SecureWorks, Managed Services, 3-year subscription. I don't know what any of that is, but it sounds very exciting.
Wow, how exciting, yes.
Now, Barton, we know that you listen. We'd like one of these for review, please. Thank you very much.
Yeah, no, I've said horrible things about it. Change my mind, Barton. Change my mind. Send me one. Or send Martin. It's your turn, isn't it, Martin?
Yes, it is, actually. It's my turn. I'll say lovely things, Barton. Send both of them my way. Now, in related news, the developer desktop survey was announced. And this is a collaboration between Canonical and Dell, seeking to get data from developers in the community to help create new lines of hardware and software that meets the needs of those users in the future.
Oh, yeah. What sort of things does it ask you?
It asks you tricky questions like, what programming languages do you use? And, well, I don't know why it asks this question. It asks what IDE you use or code editor you use. And obviously everyone clicks, you know, Visual Studio Code, because why would you select anything else? So a whole bunch of questions there. I have completed it, but I don't remember all the questions I was asked, but it's standard fare if you've ever done like the OpenStack developer survey, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And some questions around what, you know, properties of the computer are important to you.
And there's general questions about, you know, if Ubuntu could do something to make it more likely that you'd use Ubuntu for development, what would it be? And things like that.
Yes.
So sort of general open-ended, what would you like us to do questions.
Interesting. I wonder if the results will be published openly, or aggregated versions of the results will be published openly, because I'm sure that'd be interesting data for anyone, really.
Yeah, my understanding is that there will be something published publicly. I guess we have to ask Will Cook exactly what that's going to be, but we have until the end of May for people to complete that survey before there will be any disclosure as to what we've learned from it.
Cool. Next up, Jason Evangelo from Forbes has written an article about the most power-efficient 1904 flavor will surprise you. Now, Martin added this to the notes, so it might not surprise anyone, and I may be revealing the answer to his clickbait title.
Wow.
The answer is maybe Ubuntu Mate, is it?
It's not green for no reason.
Ah.
Yeah. Yeah, so yes.
Green for fast, is it?
It's green for efficiency. Yes. So it turns out that Ubuntu Mate is the most power efficient of the Ubuntu flavors. And I was going to be humble about this, but I am not. Absolutely dominates the power efficiency benchmarks and is clearly the Ubuntu flavor you should be installing on your laptop if you care for battery endurance.
Is this because it doesn't do very much?
Come on then, bring it on.
Well, I don't know, I was looking at the graphs and it's like, oh, well, you know, this one's obviously doing a lot of work here, and then Ubuntu Mate is apparently doing nothing. So I was just wondering what it is that, is it because actually some other stuff is doing a better job of whatever you're asking it to do, whereas Mate's just saying, oh, I don't know.
No, these benchmarks show that Ubuntu Mate performs the same tasks consuming less power than the other flavors.
And does it do them in the same amount of time?
Yes. So that was the surprising thing, is that on the performance side of things, Ubuntu Mate is comparable within the margin of error, or in some cases faster as well. So not only do you get performance, but you also get power efficiency. So we've hit a sweet spot there. And it's not by accident that we've actually put some work into doing this.
Right. That's what I was going to ask.
A few years ago, Phoronix did a similar benchmark, and Mate was way, way off the pace. Performance was not comparable. Power efficiency was not comparable. And we have put some effort into that over the last few years, and it's starting to show dividends now. So we've got some more to do, and I'm looking forward to 1910 because there's some more improvements in that regard coming up in Mate 122.
And are these things that the other flavors could do as well, or is this stuff that's specific to Mate?
Yes, I mean, some of it was us catching up. So some of it was us, you know, using the GPU for compositing of the window manager and things like that, where you get some efficiencies. Some of it is something that only Ubuntu Mate does, which I was curious to learn. There's a package called PM Utils that's got a whole bunch of power profiling tweaks in it, and we have that shipped by default, but the other flavors don't. So we're getting some benefit there. But then the other thing we did is we've done a whole load of code quality and code hygiene analysis too. Optimize and clean up, and we jettisoned a whole bunch of old code that was kicking around in Mate that we didn't need anymore, and optimized there as well.
Great. Next up, at the Open Infrastructure Summit, Mark Shuttleworth, CEO of Canonical, he's CEO now, isn't he? I haven't messed that up.
Yes.
Keeps changing his job. He was interviewed about Ubuntu, the Canonical IPO and OpenStack, and I think he said some very interesting things.
Oh, what did he say?
Well, the thing that I found particularly interesting was there was quite a bit of discussion about the Ubuntu desktop and where it's going. And during that conversation, Mark said some interesting things about the Linux desktop in general and the community around it, and why fragmentation is probably a natural thing for the Linux desktop, because it's often said that, you know, the problem, the reason you'll never have Linux domination on the desktop is because of fragmentation. But what he was saying was that the people who are using it are, you know, engineers. These are people like largely who, you know, they know what they want from their computer, and they're going to change it to be the way they want it. And you're never going to have one solution which works for everyone, which is why there was, he talks a bit about the, you know, the negativity around Unity, and sort of what he's learned about the community coming out of that. And I think it's really interesting to sort of see the insights that he's gathered from having gone through that process and how he views the landscape now.
Yeah, I found it interesting. So not only do end users want to, you know, fiddle with their systems and set things up just the way they like, but part of the reason that this fragmentation exists, as Mark sees it, is that the very people that are interested in creating, you know, Linux desktop stuff are interested in doing something different. and being inventive, and that in itself leads to natural fragmentation, because they will work on the things that they find interesting, not necessarily, you know, what everyone else is already doing. And Mark also made the point that, you know, he felt that the Linux desktop was failing to succeed because we hadn't actually done anything powerfully different and compelling to drive people towards the Linux desktop. And I think he was a little bit, he wasn't visibly sad, but I felt that there was some sadness there that, you know, Unity was an effort to do something very different with the Linux desktop. And for various reasons, you know, that didn't pan out. And I think that's a regret for Mark that, you know, that didn't go the way that he was hoping, especially when he said that, you know, he thinks that the likes of Apple will converge their mobile and desktop platforms, and that, you know, that Ubuntu were doing this 10 years prior.
Yeah, I found it did look like that hurt at some point in the past, and I'm pretty sure he is upset in some way that his vision didn't succeed with our product, and maybe it will succeed with others. And and there's various ways in which there've been some innovations on the desktop that we've done that at the time, he says, you know, the community wouldn't let us do it. You know, there were things we wanted to do and the community wouldn't let us, or reacted badly because we were doing them in a particular way. And he's right. Some of that was the approach we did, the way we landed it late in the cycle, or the fact that it was only available in Ubuntu and it wasn't easy to get Unity on other desktops, and we didn't make any effort to port Ubuntu to other distros. That kind of stuff didn't help either. But seeing that other people are doing, other systems are doing what we were doing, like desktop search being integrated into everything now, like every OS has some way of just pressing the super key or pressing a button and searching for everything. And the fact that we had that 10 years ago and we saw that as the primary way you would find your files and find your applications is, yeah, somewhat frustrating that everyone told us we were wrong, and it turns out everyone's doing it now. It's kind of galling.
Yeah. So a question for our listeners. One of the things Mark talks about is, you know, we haven't done anything, you know, really distinctive with the Linux desktop. So what would that be? You know, what would be futuristic, forward-looking and distinctive that the Linux desktop could do before any of the other platforms that would, you know, draw people to it? This is a slight echo of last week's discussion about, you know, advocating for people switching to Linux.
And we'll have the link to the full video of that interview in the show notes. I do recommend giving it a watch. And finally, we have some events. In fact, we have one event. It's OggCamp 2019. We're doing something a bit different this year. There is going to be a call for papers for the scheduled track, which is running now and closes on the 2nd of June. So if you would like to speak on our scheduled track, submit your talk and you might get selected. And if you don't get selected, you can still come and talk at the UN conference. And that's all from the community news this week. And now it's time for the news. Martin, what's first up in the news this week?
I saw that Pine64 have just posted their news update for May 2019. And there's a few things in here that I found interesting. Now, if you're not in the know, Pine make single board computers, a bit like the Raspberry Pi, and they also make some laptop style devices that have those SBCs inside them, so you can have low cost ARM laptops. And they're also working towards a Pine phone, a mobile phone. So in the past, if you wanted to order one of their devices, they had this built to order system. So you'd have to register your interest in a device. And when enough people had registered interest, you could buy one. Turns out that didn't work as they'd planned and users hated it. So they're getting rid of that with a simple pre-order system. So they're actually going to, you know, make batches of devices and what have you in advance and then sell, you know, put those up for order. And it's a first come, first serve basis. So that should work a bit better. But then the thing that really caught my eye was their updates on how their Pine phone development is progressing. The first thing is that Lukasz over there is very pleased to see how, in his words, the developers of all the major Linux on phone projects are working together. And he's really seeing that, you know, there's great collaboration there around the PinePhone. He then goes on to say that they've got, they're hoping to have some builds, some software builds for the phone on the dev kits that they'll be putting out some YouTube videos for later this month. And they've actually completed the case for the Pine phone as well. So they've got a mock-up of the case, so it doesn't have all of the internals yet, but there's a video coming soon about that. And that coincides with new dev kits which are coming up, and the actual phone PCB has received some fixes. So they're hoping to have the phone PCB prototypes ready mid to late summer. And if all goes well, they hope to have this phone available by the end of this year. But he does go on to caution that they, just because they have the hardware available, that they won't necessarily be selling it on day one, because they'll be waiting for one of the community projects to offer a fully functioning OS before they start to sell the device.
Does that mean it's a race to see who
can
port to
it first? Yeah, a little competition, but it sounds like a real collaborative competition going on there. So okay. I don't actually care who wins this race, because it looks really exciting. I'm looking forward to seeing how this plays out.
I'm looking at a picture of one of the dev boards, and it's, you can see all the chips on it, and then it's got one of those big spring-loaded connectors for a AA battery in the middle of it. I quite like that.
Isn't that a spring-loaded connector for an 18650 lithium-ion battery, probably?
Okay, I stand corrected.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, it's all very exciting. Looking forward to seeing the PineBook Pro and seeing what this PinePhone looks like. I've seen nothing about the PinePhone, so I'm kind of going into it green, and I'm looking forward to seeing what it might be.
Yeah, I'm excited about that. And I liked the photo in their blog. They've got the PineBook Pro running Ubuntu Mate, which I was obviously delighted to see.
Cool. Alan, what's up next?
Well, some bad news, potentially. Over on Gaming on Linux, Liam has posted about some potentially distressing news for Linux gamers. He's reported that, according to Gary Newman, who runs Facepunch Studios and their developer of Gary's Mod and more recently Rust, the Easy Anti-Cheat System are pausing their Linux development. Now, this came...
Well, isn't that good news? Because that means that Linux users can carry on cheating.
Well, it's more likely that game developers who utilize Easy Anti-Cheat as a piece of middleware that they include in their game might stop supporting Linux builds.
Ah.
Because the problem would be that the Windows users and the Mac users would be playing away nicely and not cheating, and then all these Linux people come along and are able to cheat, and that's rather unfair on the other 90% of the market. So it could mean that some developers back away from porting games to Linux. And the interesting thing is EAC, Easy Anti-Cheat, was purchased by Epic Games of Fortnite fame, and it appears they're not interested in supporting Linux either. So we're not sure whether this came from the top, from Epic, who have released some software recently, some games and a game store that doesn't run on Linux. They seem to be sending out mixed messages, because a little while ago we saw the Lutris developer talk about getting the Epic store working under Lutris. And Tim Sweeney from Epic suggested that the Lutris developer should apply for funding to help support development of this. But at the same time, internally, they don't do anything to support Linux. So it's a very weird state that Epic seem to be in.
Yeah. And as I understand it, aren't Valve working on trying to get EAC working under Proton? So those games for Windows that ship with it could potentially be unlocked that way.
Potentially, but the problem with all these anti-cheat systems is they squirrel away into the internals of the system to try and figure out if the host that's running the game is really a computer with a human being sat at it, or whether it could be a VM in a data center running a script, or even a computer in someone's home running a script. You know, they're all people running these bots that give them auto aim or clip through walls or whatever these cheats are. you know, the it's a arms race where the cheat systems are trying to battle with the anti-cheat systems in order to prevent cheaters from ruining the game for everyone else. And if those things that try and probe the internals of the host they're running on are dependent upon features that are only capable in Windows, then even under Proton, it might not work and might even show up as a, you know, a bot when running under Proton. That's been seen before where, when you run, these anti-cheat systems on non-Windows, it just thinks, oh, well, this is not a valid platform. This is clearly someone cheating. So it's very tricky and it's very difficult when a company like Epic, who aren't really super positive about Linux, own a piece of middleware that lots of developers who are positive about supporting Linux have to use.
Next up, Microsoft have announced Windows Terminal and Windows Subsystem for Linux 2.
Ooh.
So, yeah, first up, Windows Terminal is a new terminal emulator for Windows. So this isn't a replacement for CMD or PowerShell. This is the piece of software in which the command lines for both of those would be displayed. But it's actually like a modern terminal emulator like you're probably familiar with on Linux desktops. So it has tabs and tearaway windows and Unicode support and things like that. And as well as supporting CMD or PowerShell, it also supports Windows Subsystem for Linux and other command line interpreters you might have installed on Windows. So that's really cool.
You must be very excited for this because you use Windows as your workstation at work, don't you?
Yes, and I use various command line interpreters because we run Git Bash, and which is the comes with Git for Windows. And currently, we have to tell people to install a third-party terminal emulator because trying to use a terminal in any real way inside the sort of command prompt window is just absolutely dire. And lack of tabs and things like that is extremely frustrating. So yes, it's really cool. And they got a really fancy, expensive-looking marketing video for this, which is a bit of a surprise, but shows off some of the cool features.
It was nice to see the Ubuntu logo right at the start of that video.
Yeah. And also, they announced Windows Subsystem for Linux 2, which is the next iteration of running Linux environments on Windows. But it sounds like they've upped their game a bit here. So apparently this is based on a Linux 4.19 kernel, whereas I believe that the previous iteration of Windows Subsystem for Linux didn't actually run a Linux kernel.
That's right. It wasn't actually Linux.
Yeah. So what this means, this means a few things, but it means that there's going to be streamlined performance for file system operations, which is one of the big problems before. It was really slow when you were doing stuff with the file system. But the really exciting thing is that it's going to natively support Linux Docker containers.
Hmm.
So up until now, running Docker containers on Windows has been a bit of a pain. I think you've been able to run Windows containers, but if you wanted to run Linux containers, you essentially had to have an Ubuntu VM running, which was then running your container. So it didn't really give you the benefits of running containers.
This is fascinating because with an actual Linux kernel there now, this unlocks all of the little edge cases that didn't used to work before.
Mm. Yes.
Well, will it also, so as well as not running Linux, the original WSL also didn't have a standard init system. It didn't run systemd.
Right, yeah.
Before anyone complains, yes, it is a standard. Everyone's using it. They used their own special init system, which meant that a whole bunch of stuff that relied on systemd was a bit shonky to get working. Does this mean if they're running a proper Linux kernel, then they're going to ship systemd on Windows?
That is a good question.
Providing they're using stuff like C groups, then there shouldn't be any reason why not. So it will be interesting to see.
It's quite hilarious, really.
Yeah. I've got a laptop. When I bought it, it originally came with Windows 10, which I did make a disk backup with CloneZilla. I'm tempted to actually restore that with the Windows 10 that it came with so I can have a play with some of this stuff.
Mm.
So does this potentially mean that snaps might work?
Well,
yeah,
maybe. That's why I asked.
Yeah. It just occurred to me that was probably where you were going with that.
And things like, you know, graphical applications as well.
Yes. Well, you can if you have an X server running on your Windows box, you can like everything I've tried graphical wise, including like complex things like IDEs and stuff like that work. So, yeah, it might just be a bit more native. Yeah, but I'm really excited to try all this out. Right. And that is all we have time for in the news this week.
We know you've got a Facebook account, so stop sharing cat photos for a moment and like or share our posts so your friends and family can find the Ubuntu podcast.
And that is all for episode 5. Thank you very much for listening. You can come and chat with us in between shows in our Telegram channel. You can find that at ubuntupodcast.org/telegram. And you can email the show at show@ubuntupodcast.org. We will be back next week, where we're going to be talking about Librem 1, and we'll have some command line love, and we'll go over your feedback. So, yeah, we'll be back next week.